are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, December 3rd, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, faculty advisor at Columbia's School of International and Public Affairs, New Media Task Force, author of Shadow Network, Media, Money, and the Secret Hub of the Radical Right, Ann Nelson will be here. Also on the program, Bill Barr. And the Republicans have a Maddie that the DOJ Inspector General investigation finds that the 2016 probe of Trump was legit. Meanwhile, an ex-top Ukraine official says they knew of the aid freeze back in July of 2018. And following Zuckerberg's White House meeting, Trump threatens a trade war with France to stop tech companies' tax there. Meanwhile, Turkey threatens to block NATO Baltic defense plan over the Kurds in Syria. And Beto, remember that guy? He's working to flip the Texas State House.
Well done, Beto.
Brandon may have been right. This guy could be looking at the governor race. Meanwhile, Representative Duncan Hunter, fresh off of throwing his wife under the bus, now decides to plead guilty and leave Congress to corruption charges.
I feel like I was just getting to know him.
Yeah. That's two for two on the top first two guys to endorse Donald Trump. Both now convicted of a crime and having left Congress. Defense Department awards $400 million to a Trump buddy that Trump promoted. Speaking of corruption, appeals court rejects the Trump DOJ's request to resume federal executions. Bernie meets with Major League Baseball president to save 42 minor league teams around the country. That's 25% of the minor league, I guess. And lastly, this just breaking, a federal appeals court ruled that Deutsche Bank and Capital One must hand over years of President Donald Trump's financial records in compliance with House Democrats' subpoenas. This will also go to the Supreme Court. I believe this was, I'm just looking at this now for the first time, a three-judge panel, is that right? Which means that before it goes to the Supreme Court, it probably go to the full, they call it the en banc, the full Second Circuit Court. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. Thanks for being here. You know, people noticed this yesterday, and I don't know how many people noticed it, but when I said the five-time award-winning Majority Report, I looked behind me because I forgot, like, we got that YouTube plaque. I mean, five is sort of an arbitrary number. I think if we were to count up all the awards, it's probably closer to, like, six or seven or eight, maybe even. But five just sounds like a rounded number, and it would screw me up. If I changed the number of, if I said six-time award-winning Majority Report, I would probably not get through the opening. Just too much of a creature of habit. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Jamie is out today, but everybody else is here. Michael has come in. He's got his Adidas
indeed
product placement.
That's right. socially responsible company.
Are they?
No.
Oh. I was going to say, I'm a little surprised about that. Well, it doesn't, I mean, it does happen. In fact, one of our sponsors today is a pretty socially responsible clothing manufacturer. We will get to that shortly. Tomorrow, still sort of in an internal debate mode. I'm gonna pull the veil back, as it were, open the kimono, as they say, on the deliberative process here at the Majority Report as to how we make our editorial decisions. And we flipped a coin and decided probably that we shouldn't live stream tomorrow's impeachment hearings, only because there's going to be no fact witnesses. These are just opinions from constitutional scholars as to whether Donald Trump's obvious crimes reach the level of impeachment. And it is really, I think, just to backfill a political argument. Impeachment is a political process. And so I think probably what we'll do is we'll watch them in the morning. We will present to you some of the highlights. There'll be two or three key quotes that I think will suffice. Beyond that, there's going to be a lot of grandstanding by the Republicans in the Judiciary Committee. The Judiciary Committee is huge, too, incidentally. And you got people like Matt Gaetz on this thing. They're going to be throwing out a lot of junk tomorrow. And so you have seen today a bevy of reporting, and I would imagine, you know, timed releases of information that debunk all of the conspiracy theories that you will hear tomorrow from the Republicans on the Judiciary Committee. First off, the Inspector General came out with a report today, or not today, but the reporting is that Bill Barr is mad about the report. We haven't seen the full thing yet. We've just seen leaks about it. But it appears to be quite clear. Let's put it this way. It would be released if it helped Donald Trump at this point. And the Inspector General investigation shows that it was perfectly appropriate what the FBI did in initiating the investigation into the Trump campaign in 2016. That's number one. Number two, all the stuff that none of us want to have to have read into about the conspiracies that Ukraine was involved in trying to influence the outcome of the election, they have been debunked. Story out today in Politico that Richard Burr of North Carolina, Senator, Republican Senator, said in October 2017 that the Senate Intelligence Committee would be examining collusion by either campaign during the 2016 elections. And it turns out that this story came out today. The Senate interviewed Alexandra Chalupa, who we keep hearing. Denis Nunes said Chalupa like 4,000 times during a hearing. She's a Democratic consultant. And she was coordinating, supposedly, with Ukrainians. Well, apparently what Chalupa did after, and she was interviewed by the Republicans on the Senate Intel Committee. And they were focusing on this one Politico article that they all cite. That was by Ken, what's his face? I can't remember his name now. Vogel. And apparently, according to a person with direct knowledge of the closed door hearing, in which they examined this article, Chalupa in that article was quoted as saying officials at the Ukrainian embassy were helpful. It's just the quote. Were, quote, helpful to her effort to raise the alarm about Trump's campaign manager, Paul Manafort, in 2016. That same article noted there was little evidence of a top-down effort by the Ukrainian government to sabotage Trump's campaign. Politico is trying to save their own ass here, too, incidentally. That's what's going on here. In her Senate testimony, Chalupa denied serving as an intermediary between the Ukrainian embassy and the DNC. She said she had been targeted by a Russian active measure campaign. Intelligence officials have since briefed senators on Russia's attempts to pin blame for the 2016 interference on Kyiv as part of a disinformation operation. This is according to a source familiar with the briefings. So in other words, Politico is writing a story because they know that now their one story by Ken Vogel has become the sort of centerpiece, linchpin of this completely debunked conspiracy theory. And Chalupa conducted the Manafort research and outreach to the embassy on her own. She was careful because she didn't want to, the embassy was very, very careful to deal with this because they didn't want to get involved in anything political. Angus King said that he's been to 20 to 30 briefings and hearings on the subject of election interference 2016. I've never heard of one word about any culpability on the part of Ukraine. Today, Mitt Romney is the first Republican to say, I saw no evidence from our intelligence community nor from representatives today for the Department of State that there is any evidence of any kind that suggests that Ukraine interfered in our elections. All of this is being presented because in anticipation of what the Republicans are going to do tomorrow. Now, if you are a host of a cable news show or frankly, a YouTube news show, and you're going to invite a Republican on to talk about any of this, it sucks. But if you're going to do your job properly, read into some of this. So that when John Kennedy says, Chalupa and Ukraine and conspiracy theory, you can do something other than go like, come on, what? Really? No. So kudos to Chris Cuomo, who does that exactly right here with this Republican congressman who's on. Who is it again now?
Randy Weber.
Randy Weber from Texas. Talking about like all the different things. CrowdStrike, Chalupa strike. Here it is.
Chris, was CrowdStrike involved in the DCCC hacking?
Yes.
Or is CrowdStrike in part owned by Ukrainian?
No.
Really?
Yes.
That's not the information. Yes, really? Or yeah, that's not the information that we have.
And you have bad information. The man is American, born of Russian descent. He's not Ukrainian. And even if he were, that's what you're going to hang it on? Your head of national security, Tom Bossert, said that was a joke. You heard testimony from experts saying it's a joke. The intel community says it's not true. Mueller said it's not true. Burr said it's not true.
What Trump is saying is go back and let's look at all of the information on the DCCC server that helped
fight
against his campaign.
They operated in a cloud system. There is no server to steal.
No server, but they were hacked into, and the president wanted that investigated. It's one of the things that he gave to President Zelensky as an example of corruption.
It was investigated. What he went to Zelensky with was a conspiracy theory that there's some missing server. When there is no physical server, CrowdStrike and the FBI both said it.
I mean, there you have it. I mean, good for Chris Cuomo to actually read into it. But look at the people he cited. Richard Burr, Republican chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. The former head of the Department of Homeland Security appointed by Trump said the same thing. At one point, if you're one of those people out there who keeps talking about this, you're either willfully ignoring the facts, you refuse to believe anybody, or you're just, I don't know what you're doing. I mean, I understand what, Weber's doing. He's either an idiot or he's just trying to maintain, good graces with Donald Trump. But there's a lot of people out there who are just sort of pushing this stuff. We need to investigate the investigators. Well, it's happening. Bill Barr, one of the most corrupt attorney generals that I think we've had in a significant period of time. And I lived through this guy. Where is that?
Only God, no other king. Let the might.
But didn't he actually, not to in any way clean his image up, but didn't he like...
He and Comey had that. They stopped some of the worst of the spine.
They needed to intimidate him in his hospital bed.
Yes, it was Comey who was there with him actually at the time. The Bill Barr is now mad at the Inspector General of the DOJ. Now, if we have just that deep of a deep state, then roll it up anyways. Spend your time off Twitter and go enjoy yourself. I don't know. I mean, it's like that is now, it seems to me, just incredibly discrediting. And people have to justify why they're saying this stuff when there's absolutely no evidence for it. The fact that Manafort had been exposed by literally a group called, what was it? The Ukrainian Anti-Corruption Organization, which is the one that that exposed this black ledger. An independent Ukrainian government agency, the National Anti-Corruption Bureau of Ukraine. And this was, it showed that Paul Manafort had committed crimes there. That's just the bottom line of it. I mean, I believe me, it makes me nauseous to have to go through this stuff. But this is just the playing field that we play with. And, you know, we're going to talk to Ann Nelson. Some of, you know, what we're dealing with today and what she's talking about in this sort of network of funding on the right, it's also a function of our media, of deficiencies in our media. All right, now I just got all excited and I lost all my ad copy. Now, here we go.
Never get so excited you lose the ad, speaking of media.
Support for today's show comes from The New Yorker. As you know, because you're smart, because you listen to this show, The New Yorker represents the best writing in America today. You can enjoy the works of Emily Nussbaum. She's the television critic for The New Yorker, who in 2016 won the Pulitzer Prize for Criticism. Or Doreen St. Felix, staff writer at The New Yorker, covers the highs and lows of today's culture. 2019, she won the Ellie Award for Columns and Commentary. Or John Cassidy covers politics and economics for The New Yorker. He's written articles on topics ranging from the intelligence failures before the Iraq War to the economics of John Maynard Keynes. For me, it's like literally the idea that The New Yorker advertises on the show gives me a huge amount of credibility in the eyes of my family, friends. It's impressive, but also it's great writing. I watch The Irishman this weekend.
And good flick.
And it's a good flick, but also I read Richard Brody's take on it today, watching The Irishman on Netflix. Best way to see it. This type of it's stories like that. Now, of course, there's a ton of best books of the year. Emily Katie Wallman writes about, but there's also stories on how history will judge the Republicans defending Trump on impeachment, and I mean just a whole Hip Camp. I got to check that out actually. The writing there is fantastic. Great takes on news stories. A great way to read some short fiction. And now you can just get you can get 12 weeks for just $6, plus the New Yorker tote bag, weekly home delivery of the print edition, and an unlimited access to NewYorker.com. And they've got 10 to 15 exclusive site-only stories a day. When you go to NewYorker.com/majority, enter the code MAJORITY. You're also going to be able to access the apps, the online archive, the crossword puzzle, and more. Again, that's NewYorker.com/majority. Enter the code MAJORITY, save 50% on a 12-week subscription, and get the exclusive tote. Meanwhile, we were talking about clothing manufacturers that are socially responsible, well, would you buy a t-shirt for $50 if you knew it only cost $7 to make? I wouldn't. Everlane only makes premium essentials. Your t-shirts, your basic button-downs, the clothes you wear, the workhorses of your clothing, of your closet, essentially. They use the finest materials without traditional markups. They want you to know what you're paying for and why. So they're radically transparent about their real costs and the costs on every step of their process, from the materials they use to the ethical factories they work with, Michael. Not to mention essentials like Love a it. Cotton Crew t-shirt are exactly what they should be. They're versatile, simple, stylish, made from quality materials. Everlane's clothes look better, they cost less, they last longer. I have Everlane sneakers. I am currently wearing, as I sit here, Everlane, what do they call them? The boxers.
Briefs?
No, the boxer briefs, exactly. They're awesome. I wore the same ratty type of underwear for years and years and years. I upgraded, and honestly, I feel better every day. Every
we noticed
single
it.
Day.
There was a whole conversation here in the office, and we're like, you know what it must be? New underwear.
Seriously. Plus, they got 100% grade A cashmere. Like I said, they got the quality cotton basics. They got sustainable silks.
I have one of those cashmere sweaters from Everlane. It's amazing.
I also have a hoodie. It's not the zipper kind, but the other kind. But it's sweet. Incredibly comfortable.
My favorite hoodie is from Everlane.
I put that thing on. I fall asleep immediately. They have perfectly fit Oxford shirts. Right now, you can check out our personalized collection at everlane.com/majority. Plus, you'll get free shipping on your first order. That's everlane.com/majority. Everlane.com/majority. And lastly, what do I sleep in besides my Everlane underwear? Well, my Brooklinen sheets. This holiday season, it's time to gift the ones you love or yourself something just a little bit cozier. Lucky for you, Brooklinen is having their biggest sale yet this Black Friday through Cyber Monday. Well, I hope it's still going on. But I got to tell you, I've got now multiple sets of Brooklinen sheets. I've got a Brooklinen comforter. I'm eyeing some Brooklinen towels. There has not been a single thing I've gotten from Brooklinen that I haven't loved. Apparently, it's the home of the internet's favorite sheets. They got over 50,000 five-star reviews and counting. And now Brooklinen, like I said, has moved beyond the bedroom to offer essentials for your bathroom, like towels, shirt, shower curtains, bath mats, and even an ultra-soft loungewear. I didn't know about that. All without the luxury markup. Do you like softness? Do you like comfort? How about essentials to help you relax? Brooklinen has it all. Brooklinen.com is having the biggest sale ever, and it's happening right now for Black Friday, Cyber Monday. Brooklinen is so confident in their product that all their sheets, comforters, and towels come with a lifetime warranty. The only way to get access to the biggest event and free shipping is to go to Brooklinen.com. Brooklinen.com today, buy today. And if you're just hearing this and it's post-Black Friday and Cyber Monday, you can still use the promo code MAJORITY at brooklinen.com for 10% off and free shipping anytime. Brooklinen, everything you need to live your most comfortable life. Check it out. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Ann Nelson on the Shadow Network, Media, Money, and the Secret Hub of the Radical Right. We'll be right back.
Back to you.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program a faculty and research fellow at Columbia University and author of Shadow Network, Media, Money, and the Secret Hub of the Radical Right. Ann Nelson, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Sam.
So now I got to tell you, this is really, I really enjoyed this, this book, because in many respects, this is stuff that I used to pay a lot more attention to like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, even. And it seems like it went sort of, it seemed that it submerged a bit, maybe during the Obama years and even in the lead up to the Trump election. But it has been there apparently this whole time. And you give us at the top of the book a dramatis personae. Maybe I'm mispronouncing that, but it is basically lays out the characters essentially in this book. But they're characters who make up this network of people that is very much at the core a religious movement. Would you say, or how would you describe it?
Well, I'd go back to one of the founders of it, Richard Viguerie, who talks about it as a three-legged stool. So you've got the socially conservative fundamentalists, religious fundamentalists, and their causes are to reverse women's reproductive rights and LGBT civil and political rights. Then you've got the economic interests, which include a lot of extractive industries, oil barons in Texas, miners in the West, whose goal is to eliminate environmental regulations and taxes and social programs. And then the third leg really involves the political strategists themselves, like Richard Viguerie and some of the other founders, who really were masterminds of political mechanics that serve to thwart the majority. It's how to energize minority voters in swing states that achieve their political agenda.
Now, I can't remember if it was Weyrich or Viguerie who was famous for saying, "We don't want people to vote because that helps us."
Well, yeah, Weyrich says we want our people to vote, and we want to basically discourage the other people from voting. And that has been a strategy that has played out very well in their favor.
Indeed. Now, I mean, will you just walk us through that sort of like, where was the impetus? Because it wasn't until the early to mid 70s, in the wake of the of Roe v. Wade, that the Christians, I guess, self-identified Christians and evangelical Christians were terribly politicized, I guess. And just give us a sense of like who approached whom in this dynamic.
Right. Well, and I like to be it's impossible to be precise in this terminology, but, you know, Christians involves a huge expanse of Americans and others, many of whom would totally disagree with this project. Evangelicals include moderates and liberals and all kinds of people who are not politicized. So I'm talking about a narrow band who are mostly fundamentalists, and many of them are based in the Southwest. A lot of them subscribe to kind of 19th century Southern values, like states' rights against the federal government. And in the early days, they were pushing back against school integration. And they banded together after Barry Goldwater's loss and got behind Ronald Reagan and helped him win through the Southern Strategy in 1980, hoping that he would promote their cause. In 1981, these groups came together and founded something called the Council for National Policy, which is intentionally the most boring name in the world. And then they used this network that includes media, major donors contributing millions of dollars, political strategists, and used it in a highly targeted state-by-state basis to advance their agenda over the last 40 years.
you also used the term Christian nationalist. Will you break that out for us?
Well, there is a group of people in the United States who believe that, first of all, they have a direct line to God, and that God gives them directions that they should impose on the rest of us. And that includes Christians who are not of their belief. That includes certainly every non-Christian. And beyond that, they have these two relationships to authoritative documents as they see it. They believe in what they call biblical inerrancy, which is that every word of the Bible is the literal truth. So they're against the teaching of evolution in schools. They're against a lot of things. Of course, they can't really make sense of this because the Bible decrees a lot of things that aren't realistic in modern life. You must stone an adulterer to death. Well, if we implemented that on a mass scale, there would be real trouble.
Even if we did that on a small scale, there'd be trouble.
Well, you know, I just haven't ever seen it work. And so they also impose this idea on the U.S. Constitution, and they say that the founders of the Republic were Christians, that they believed that God and their form of religion is an essential foundation of American government. Now, many constitutional scholars really debate this, and they talk about the role of freedom of religion and freedom not to have religion as a foundation of U.S. government. And the other problem is that if you bring this kind of biblical inerrancy idea to the Constitution, you come up with things that were approved, such as slavery, such as depriving women of political rights, etc. So a lot of their followers don't really look into their arguments very closely. They tend to hear the headlines and proceed out of emotion and don't really examine the text.
I was struck by on that list of folks that you cover and sort of like some of the players in terms of the fundamentalists. You know, you go down that list. There are people I used to talk about quite a bit, guys like Tony Perkins and Tim LaHaye, who had the series of Left Behind series about, how we're all, well, not all. I don't know where I end up, but
I'm afraid you're left behind.
I had
and
a feeling.
So am I.
I'll be left behind. But and also James Dobson. I mean, I used to just pour through James Dobson's parenting guides for, you know, comedy and things that were disturbing, frankly. But these guys, they're not names that you hear that often. But the other person on that page is Mike Pence. And I interviewed a biographer of Mike Pence's, I guess it was about a year ago or so from now, actually. And he told me that Mike Pence is the most powerful theocrat that has ever risen as far, this far in our government. Where does Pence fit into this network prior to becoming vice president?
Well, Mike Pence became a favorite son of the Council for National Policy as early as 2008. And they really reached out to him and cultivated him for the presidency over the years. This is laid out in Tom LoBianco's recent biography of Pence. And so Pence has made numerous appearances at the secret meetings of the Council for National Policy. And then just a few months ago, he tweeted a very public photograph of him praising the Council for National Policy. And I lay out in the book that the scenario by which the deal was cut with Donald Trump to become their favored candidate. And part of that deal was to ditch Trump's first choice for running mate, Chris Christie, and replace it with Mike Pence.
I mean, just walk us through that, because it is, I mean, there's two things that I feel like struck me about that deal was there was a lot of reporting at the time that a lot of self-identified evangelical Christians who were Trump supporters don't seem to go to church on some level. But the other thing is that Mike Pence was instrumental in his victory. I mean, walk us through that, how that happened, and then maybe we should get into who are some of the big players in the Council for National Policy.
Sure. In my book Shadow Network, I really kind of lay out the 40-year arc. And we come into the 2016 elections, and I should add that over this time, a lot of the professional news media in the middle of the United States is failing economically. You have newspapers going away, local radio stations that reported professional news being bought up and replaced by chains of fundamentalist radio stations. You have a rapid growth in fundamentalist television broadcasting. So you have this voters block of mostly older, white, somewhat rural Christian voters who may or may not be registered to vote, who may or may not go and vote. And so the strategists decided that if they could activate 18 million of these people in specific states, swing states, that could tip the election regardless of the popular election outcome. So they got behind their favorite candidates. Ted Cruz was of their culture. His father is a fundamentalist pastor who's extremely conservative, very much a Christian nationalist. So Ted Cruz grew up in this world. He is absolutely of it. But the problem was that Ted Cruz, in the end, did not win the primaries. I believe partly because his charisma deficit. So
that's
here
being
they were
very generous.
I try. So here they were with Donald Trump winning the primaries. And of course, the Southern Baptist leaders, many of them had been on records being never Trumpers and saying, this is not a man of God. He breaks all of our rules. And they had to deal with that. So Tony Perkins, who was then the head of the Council for National Policy, helped the other leaders convene a huge gathering on June 21st, 2016, and worked with Ralph Reed, another member of the Council for National Policy, whose name you may recall, to bring together 1,000 fundamentalist leaders from all over the country for a kind of show and tell with Donald Trump. Trump had won the primaries based on his celebrity and his flamboyance. But he didn't have campaign financing. He didn't have ground troops. He didn't have a party behind him. So he really had very poor prospects going into the general elections. The Council for National Policy affiliates had all of the above, strategists, money, ground troops. So they go into the Marriott Marquis, this big, you know, a hotel on Times Square, and into the ballroom, and they basically cut a massive deal. And they hand Trump a list of requirements. One is to make up an evangelical advisory council, and a third of these so-called religious advisors are members of the Council for National Policy. A second element is to allow the heads of CNP affiliates to give him the names of acceptable judges to nominate for the federal courts. These organizations are the National Rifle Association, the Federalist Society, and the Heritage Foundation. The third element was to have Mike Pence serve as his running mate and thereby bring in as many of his fundamentalist followers as possible. And then another element was to let them, including Tony Perkins himself, write homophobic elements of the Republican platform for the national convention. And all of a sudden, the Republican platform comes out, and journalists are saying, this is the most reactionary platform we've seen in 80 years, and we're not quite sure why Tony Perkins should be writing social elements of it. But there it is. So it all comes out of this meeting, at which point all of the forces connected to the Council for National Policy and its affiliates and its it's other organizations and it's churches go to work and perform the big push for Trump leading into November.
And the rest, I guess, as they say, is history in that regard.
Well, and there's an interesting element of that history, because as we know, all of the national media said Hillary Clinton has it in the bag. She did win the popular vote by 3 million. But then Trump won the Electoral College by less than 100,000 votes spread over three states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. Now, as it happens, the Council for National Policy and its donor circles had enacted right-to-work laws crippling the unions in Michigan and Wisconsin in the previous 8 years. They've deprived Democrats of 3 to 4% of their vote. So you have this really elegantly defined mechanism that's working in very targeted ways. And I have to say that one can only conclude that the Democratic National Party was asleep at the wheel.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's at the very least. And the thing is that back in 2004, there was it didn't seem to be as sort of targeted of, although to a certain extent it was, I guess, theory about bringing even more of those evangelicals out. When the Bush administration was placing anti-marriage equality referendum on key states. I don't know if they were doing it or is it part of a greater network, putting these referendums on key states to drive out that vote in the 2004 election.
Yeah, there's a lot of coattail election mechanics going on here. So this organization and its affiliates, it's connected to something called the State Policy Network. It's connected to something called the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC. Mm-hmm. And so they'll work on local propositions, including opposing marriage equality, in favor of gun control, and then drive out these voters, often with misleading or outright false campaign material, and inflammatory material. And then when they get them to the polls on this hot button issue for them, they'll vote down the ticket for Republicans. So this happened with gun control propositions in California. This happened with marriage equality in a number of states. And I have to say that after immersing myself in this research, I feel that very little of it involves deeply held principle. A lot of it grows out of focus groups and polling and just seeing how they can activate certain blocks of voters.
And you mentioned that the Council for National Policy funders and, I guess, affiliates were heavily, I guess, associated with, at the very least, I can see Wisconsin and Michigan, right? Because you're talking about, and I want to go into this, because, you know, one of the things that that struck me was, like, how did Betsy DeVos and Richard Prince show up so intimately in Donald Trump's circles, right? And maybe all these billionaires just hang around with each other, but the DeVos's and the Kochs were you know, DeVos obviously huge in Michigan, the Koch brothers huge in Wisconsin. Tell us about their I guess relationship with the CNP.
Well, the DeVos family goes back goes way back in time with this group, and they have been major donors to James Dobson, whom you mentioned, and his focus on the family empire, which includes, you know, countless books and radio stations and television appearances. It's really a media empire that would probably be invisible to most people in, you know, eastern urban areas. But it has a lot of clout. And Dobson founded the Family Research Council, which Tony Perkins became head of. So Betsy DeVos's family, the Princes, and her brother Eric Prince, who was of Blackwater fame and is now active with the Trump administration on military matters, the Prince family was very active as donors, and so was the family that she married into, which was the Richard DeVos family. And we're talking about a family that's sitting on $5 to $6 billion from their Amway Corporation, which is multi-level marketing that has run into various regulatory problems over the years, shall we say. So Betsy DeVos has really made a career out of opposing funding for public education, opposing support for public school teachers. And when she's nominated for the to be Secretary of Education, a lot of educators were just flabbergasted. I mean, she was negatively qualified to work on public education. And the movement got behind her. Mike Pence cast the deciding vote for her nomination. She's proceeded to be an adversary to public education since. And she is not herself, to my knowledge, a member of the Council for National Policy, but her mother, her father-in-law, her brother, and her husband have been. So I call her the crown princess of the movement.
And we should say, I'm paraphrasing, but there was an interview that she gave with her husband. She was talking about, we don't have an issue with public education. We just have an issue with public schools. And the idea being, we want this pot of money that goes towards the, you know, public education in quotes. And we want to basically be able to give it to parochial schools.
And to homeschooling.
Yep.
All right. So her real, and this is part of the vision of the movement. Because if you go to a public school, you're going to be exposed to different populations, ethnicities, you're going to be exposed to different ideas. And within this movement's religious schools and homeschooling, kids could go through high school never being exposed to the concept of evolution, right? They could be go through high school with never being exposed to sex education because they don't believe in that either. So it's a matter of a broader system of controlling the information that people get. They're against mainstream media, news media. They are against public universities. So there are just so many counts on which they wish to protect people from the influence of education and information.
You know, I want to touch on both those. Let's start though with campuses, because to the extent that they can influence people who stay within the bubble, they're it seems to me they're also attempting with less success to influence people who are outside that bubble. You bring up Charlie Kirk in the book. The timing is pretty good in terms of this nexus. He just launched an initiative with Jerry Falwell at Liberty University called the Falkirk. What is it? It's the Falkirk Center for, revanchivist ideas. I'm not sure exactly what the actual title is. What is it? Yes, the Falkirk Center for Faith and Liberty. Just give us a sense of where, Charlie Kirk falls in this. I've had some conversations with him about, you know, who funds him, and he was a little bit cagey about it. I'm curious as to how close he is to this network.
Well, I have learned since the book was published a couple of months ago that he has become a member of the Council for National Policy. And he is being presented as the leader of the youth wing. So he has not disclosed where his funding comes from. He has been on record that he's received some funding from this donor network. And they promote him heavily. His speeches are promoted on some of their digital media. And he's really trying to organize this younger generation, because a lot of members of this movement are aging out. And it's not clear where future leadership will come from. A lot of the donors are aging out. But on the other hand, they've got a problem, because demographically, time is not on their side. Americans are more accepting of marriage equality, and public opinion is fine with it. Americans are in favor of certain measures of gun control. And they also are accepting of many forms of abortion, especially in the first trimester. So their absolutist measures get less and less support from public opinion, which means that they have to find ways to circumvent public opinion and majority rule in order to implement them.
It's fascinating because that you make that point. We've been watching for the past couple of weeks as Charlie Kirk has tried to make Turning Points USA seem more gay friendly, frankly, and a little bit more, I think, modern. And they have been now attacked from their right for doing so. For the you know, and I think there's a fairly good argument about the hypocrisy there and the disingenuousness of it as well. But be that as it may, you sort of touched on this, but I want to dive a little deeper in this before we finish. The concept of this creation of an alternate media. And the idea of how, I mean, there's a quality to this. Maybe you're not comfortable with this analogy, but, you know, with Dianetics, like where there's out in Hollywood, where there is a sort of like a semi-secret society that basically helps each other's members and sort of lifts people up and, you know, helps to promote people. That does not exist. It seems to me to exist on the right. It does not exist on the left. I mean, you write about Salem Media. I happen to have done AM talk radio for years and would watch how the Salem radio hosts would also get paid by other entities. And there was just a whole sort of almost like web, if you will, network, I guess, of support that would come seemingly from like different directions. But I get the sense that it was really all emanating out of sort of a couple of people. They were just sending it out into like 5 or 10 different directions, and it would come back at people who are on the other end of the receiving of that largesse. Will you talk about the separate media world that they created? Because it's almost analogous to, like, I mean, it seems to me it's happened writ large now that, you know, Fox and AM talk radio have managed to create that as well. But it seems to have started really with, like, you know, when you get down to the sort of the more pure stuff, it was like Christian broadcasting.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear you say that, Sam, because I grew up in Oklahoma and I go back to see family a lot. And I've lived in New York City for the last, you know, few decades. And, you know, when I came across these radio stations in the Midwest, I came back to New York and nobody had heard of Salem Media. And, you know, they were recently called the fifth largest radio broadcaster in the country. They've got any number of internet digital platforms. They've got a book publishing company. They are a media powerhouse. And the thing is that since this fairness doctrine was defeated by Reagan in 1987, these broadcasters have no responsibility to offer professional news reporting or to present two sides of any issue. So what you get is this unidirectional messaging by these hosts who are basically telling people what to think, telling them one side of a story, often falsified. And also, as you say, part of this economic network where Council for National Policy organizations such as the Leadership Institute will advertise on Tony Perkins' show from the Family Research Council, and the revenues will just flow round and round. Yep. And you go back to some of the major donors, the Princes, the DeVosses, Foster Freese, the Templeton Foundation, et cetera. The Koch brothers came into it late in 2010, from what I can tell, but they're not as much part of this donor system. But you have what professional news reporting having its economic crisis, which winnows out a lot of quality news organizations. These these broadcasters rush to fill the vacuum with utterly one-sided cases. And people are actually told by these radio hosts that it's their Christian obligation to vote a certain way and to run for office and represent this movement. So you're talking about states where people spend a lot of time in their cars. And my friends in New York say, oh, they're all listening to podcasts. No, the older people turn on the radio, and a lot of the younger ones do too. And you are bombarded with this messaging from town to town across the plain states.
Well, I mean, I guess lastly, what is there a solution to this? Or let me rephrase that. What should the response by those of us who may not just simply have that level of awareness that, wow, I could live my entire life in a lot of these states and literally hear no dissent? I mean, I just keep thinking about, there was a clip of a woman who went to a Justin Amash town hall and in Michigan. And he was there to explain why he was for impeachment, based upon the Mueller report. And there was a woman who was there who was just absolutely shocked. She thought the Mueller report exonerated Trump. Mm-hmm. And she was just shocked to hear Justin Amash, who she also apparently had some affinity for, tell her that, no, that's not what it says at all. I mean, that's pretty amazing that there could be such a concerted and cohesive and comprehensible effort to create a completely different narrative amongst tens of millions of people.
Yeah. And again, part of that is because people who owned a lot of our professional news media got greedy a few decades ago and allowed local news coverage to wither, starved local newspapers and local radio stations of resources. And that's a big issue in this question. 2 years ago, I just dropped everything to write Shadow Network because I felt that we were in a period of political crisis, which I still believe. It's heavily documented. I think people who read it will get ideas about how they would like to respond. I would say, first of all, rebuild the national conversation. Don't vilify each other. Listen and explain and try to understand what kind of sourcing will connect people and rebuild a sense of trust. And that means a really strong focus on people in what is dismissively called the flyover. I mean, I'm sorry, that's disrespectful. There are incredible people working in these states. They've been barraged with this misinformation. There has to be a national conversation on a new level. But I would say that once, if we get past November 2020, there has to be a serious effort to rebuild a national news media system where you don't just have elite news institutions on the coast broadcasting their points of view to the rest of the country. It has to be woven together and mutually respectful, and representing really different regional and cultural points of view. And that's a longer effort, but I don't think democracy can survive without it.
Ann Nelson, the book is Shadow Network, Media, Money, and the Secret Hub of the Radical Right. Thanks so much for your time today. We'll put a link to that book at majority.fm. Thanks again.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, folks. Going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get extra content every day. You get the free show, free of commercials. And you support everything that we do here. And our attempts, it's butterfly wings. But George Soros, if you're listening, if you're willing to just drop off a bag of cash, we will expand. We will try and reach those folks. I mean, I do have a dream that I doubt will ever be realized of buying up some of those or renting some of those sticks, as we used to call it in the radio business. Those unused sticks in states like Wisconsin and Michigan, Pennsylvania. Low power. And broadcasting podcasts on radio. But that's not going to happen. I mean, I'm not going to discourage anybody who's listening to the program for funding for something like that. But in the meantime, we're trying to expand what we offer here. And who knows? Who knows? Hope springs eternal. But you can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Usually you use the coupon code majority, you get 10% off. Right now, I think they're having a big pre-Christmas sale, 30% off. Go check it out. Go buy the Majority Report blend. Try that out. 30% off. All of these coffees are incredibly inexpensive for high-quality coffee. Free shipping. And don't forget, you can sign up for the AM Quickie at amquickie.com. That's completely free. And it's 5 minutes every day with the headlines you need to know to start your day. So amquickie.com. You can find all that on the app, majorityapp.com. Michael, today is Tuesday, and that means the Michael Brooks Show day.
Yes, indeed. Tonight is jam-packed. We are going to be talking about AMLO's record in Mexico. Then Big Waz, Wozni Lambre from The Athletic and Count the Dings joins us to talk about the NBA ratings dip and the state of the primary and why Rudy Giuliani and Michael Bloomberg, you could use their two biographies to tell us everything wrong with the state of the world. And then we're going to play our conversation with Slavoj Žižek that has been behind a paywall, a bunch of other things. And in the post game, we are going to have a labor union organizer, one of the organizers of the protests and strikes happening right now in Colombia, is going to be calling us directly from Colombia to basically tell us what the hell is going on. So hell of a lot to get to. Patreon.com/TMBS. Michael Brooks Show on YouTube.
Jamie Zappa, you can check out the Antifada at the Antifada, excuse me, patreon.com/theAntifada. Matt.
Yeah, most recently on Literary Hangover, I did Arthur Miller's The Crucible with Alex and Grace, and we talked about the McCarthyite context of that. So Arthur Miller and Marilyn Monroe versus the House Un-American Activities Committee. So check that out, folks. 2 hours and 42 minutes. So it's a big, long one.
Whoa.
Is this true that Kamala's out?
Oh, is that right?
I'm seeing some hints that some,
there's definitely blood in the water.
Yeah,
I mean there was a sort of a throw everybody under the bus piece.
When you get to that phase in the campaign when everybody's writing the like,
one of her staffers,
the real problem was everybody else.
One of her staffers, I think, left for Bloomberg's campaign.
Ooh, that's cold. Only Clinton people could do that. Sorry, you needed to get all of our dregs, Kamala.
Well, I mean, he's hiring.
Available.
Again, I think it really is the first time in history that we've seen anybody literally buy an option to run as an independent in the general election. That's basically it. That is what he's done. He has bought an option to do so.
I was correct on, I undersold Beto, but man, was I wrong about Harris. I thought she would be very formidable in that center lane, but nope.
I mean, I think part of the problem was she just couldn't figure out where she wanted to. She had no sort of the one brand I think that would have been obvious for her, they got overly sensitive to early on. I mean, this is where, I mean, I think, you know, part of the story of this campaign, I think, is going to be one way or another, how overly influential Twitter has been in this campaign. And by that, I mean, I think the Harris people got the heebie-jeebies because they saw on Twitter the stuff about her being a prosecutor. I think,
say, frankly, in this case, this would be a positive example of people using that to highlight.
Oh, yeah,
a
good job.
Oh, horrifying record.
Yeah, no, but I think that, you know, the fact is that
it needn't have been such a liability.
Well, there was also that New York Times piece that, I mean, just on the traditional tip, there was a New York Times piece that came out, I think, like in the first week. And I remember you telling me specifically, you were like, you know, this piece is getting shared by people I know who would have been really open to her. And that really cracks some ice too.
Yes, I think so. But I think the groundwork was laid for that on Twitter, which, you know, has a lot of its consumers on the political sort of like thread, is the consumers are journalists. And I also think, frankly, like, I think Warren coming out with her financing plan and with her sort of two-step Medicare for All, I think that was also a function of overreacting to Twitter on some level. I mean, I just don't think the broader Democratic electorate was demanding this finance stuff. And I think, you know, one of the things that it used to be, all these campaigns would be just terrified of the Beltway media, because that was the only narrative that would exist. And so David Broder and Tim Russert would drive the narrative by because they had the playing field to themselves. And I think in the same way that that narrative was over, not represented, but overreacted to, I think it's also on some level, you know, these campaigns can overreact to Twitter, particularly when there's some measure of defensiveness that already is there. Right? Like, people can mock me for wearing sweatsuits, but it's not going to have the same resonance as it would for other people because I don't wear sweatsuits. Oh, yeah. Right. And so,
anyway. Ironically, in both cases, none.
What's that?
I said in both cases, the effect would actually be none.
Right.
I mean,
well,
I'm not releasing a post sweatsuits plan.
Well, all right, we'll see.
I'm the Bernie of this.
We'll see. That's possible. You could be all in on the sweatsuit, and that is the point. I think that is one of the advantages that Bernie has, is that he just doesn't have any other positions, and so he's not going to get defensive.
Well, and I also thought, that's also why his tweet that was one of the most effective messaging. He said something. He said, "I'll say something new when we solve the problems I've talked about for 40 years."
Yep,
that's good.
Go ahead.
Well, I also think that besides Twitter, I think what influenced Warren is the constituency she was picking up and the type of people
with her branding, because she went so hard on all that wonk branding.
Yeah,
and that hurt her, right?
I wonder if there was like skeptics of.
Well, yeah, but where are those people? Well, they're like, not out. They're not your.
Well,
they could be the people
too.
That come to her events, basically.
But Twitter, political media.
I think Twitter. political media, but. Political media. I don't think it's that different. I mean, that's exactly right. That's my point, is that I think that like she could have maintained that branding even with, Twitter people saying like, you haven't come up with a finance plan. And but instead, I think they overreacted to it.
Yeah. And just yesterday, Bloomberg overtook her in the polls. So I guess that put her at 2%.
Harris.
Yeah.
Harris, yes. Well, Harris had no. I mean, yeah. I think that was it. That was a Johnny ball game. And again, I think Harris is just Bloomberg just purchasing an option to run in the general.
You would be the first African American woman president. I would be the first miniature Jewish president. But we both love stopping and frisking, young men of color.
There you go.
Pass the baton.
There you go.
And hand in the soda.
It gives her a pole position on VP pick. We came together from totally different backgrounds, but we came together on our desire to over-police black people.
She, the daughter of a Marxist economist. Me, a computer terminal creator.
Just thinking
both
about...
Both laughing at the slogan, education, not incarceration. It tickles both of us.
It's the worst new Marvel Cinematic Universe show.
Yeah, exactly. All right, folks, see you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabs.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.